This is FM 2.0 with the Don, Dean, Stormy, and the Grizz. Forever music. Music.
So I wanted to play that clip because it's such a beautiful song. Your bass, especially in that bridge instrumental, that bass just is so beautifully pronounced.
Okay. Okay. That is actually, that record, most of it was recorded before I joined the band. So that happens to be Michael Devon playing with that.
Yeah. Is that you in the video, though? That's you in the video.
But a year later, they shoot the video after the song was recorded.
Oh. Rudy, he brought that up because I got to spend some time with the guests who recently, man, they love you.
I love those guys. It was a really tough decision to actually leave the Guess Who to come back home to Quiet Riot because it was so wonderful. And I always look for that special situation, like let's say playing with Ronnie James Dio was actually playing with Ronnie James Dio, being on stage with him. That's why I left home to go on the road with him, just for that special, I cannot get this anywhere else but playing with Ronnie James Dio. And the same thing playing in the Guess Who with Gary Peterson, the original drummer of the band. As a bass player, we're a rhythm section. It's a relationship, musical relationship, and then it becomes also a personal relationship that we have because we speak to each other when we play. So to actually play with a person that I grew up listening to their playing on the radio, that was very so special, man. I learned so much from him. I always, because... if you ever interview Gary, he's a wealth of information. As a matter of fact, he started playing drums before rock and roll existed. So he was part of that whole rock and roll evolution. He was actually playing jazz, like with Lenny Burrell, all these great jazz musicians out in Winnipeg in clubs. And he was a kid. He was not old enough to be able to attend a club, but he could play. So once they finished playing, he had to go to the kitchen. He couldn't hang out in the club itself. So that was definitely very, very special.
Yeah, he showed me a picture when he was 4 years old. I think it was like 1949 with him behind the kit performing. But I went to the show. I was with them in the green room after the show, and I had probably like three different conversations going on with different members. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Somehow I had referenced a comment you made last time we talked to you. And it's like the moment I said, Rudy, all the conversation stopped and everybody came around. And it was about you and the warmth that everybody had. Gary started talking about you. It was just a very, very powerful, very sincere love for you. And they were all like, well, tell Rudy we said hi. And yeah, I just wanted to pass that along. It's like, wow, they really, they love you.
Yeah. Yeah. You obviously, you can tell that the feeling is mutual because I really love them too. Really did. Yeah. Really do. Yeah.
Is there I wanted to definitely pass that along.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Is there a particular Guess Who song that affected you in your like?
Oh yeah, sure. Undone.
Undone.
Yeah.
Undone, really?
You know, yeah. It's because it's such a different song from anything else in the set. And growing, you know, that was as close to Latin music as a rock band was playing at the time. You know, because it was kind of like a bossa nova type feel to it. You know. And so when I actually got to play that and play with Gary, you know, it's all about the feel of the drums and the percussion, you know, and it was just amazing. Another one is American Woman, because, you know, Gary explained to me what the origin of the song, but just, you know, just talking about his drum part, he said that at the time that he was inspired by Buddy Miles, who at the time happened to have a double bass drum kit, drum kit. And there's a certain pattern that if you don't play like Gary, the song does not sound the same. So it had to be played a certain way. I mean, there's a certain thing. And then the bass has to play along with it. So there's only one way to play that song correctly.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah, I've really been talking up. I think that new album Plendemore is incredible. So I've been talking
it's
up.
A great record. Yeah.
It's definitely caused a conversation because you know there's a lot of people that have the mindset. Well, if Randy, if Burton aren't in him, it's not the Guess Who. But I say, look, Gary was right there from the start too. And more importantly, this is an incredible album. So just listen to the album. You know, measure the band on the album and what they're trying to do with moving the next chapter forward. So, yeah, a lot of conversations around that.
Absolutely.
And some ways, it's similar to Quiet Riot right now in that there's been such a change there with the band, too.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was an inevitable change because it's mostly due to, well, it's due to two members passing.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like they've been replaced. It's they pass and then we try to find musicians that can help us go out there and celebrate the legacy of the band with as much dignity as possible.
Yeah, one of the things that I've really found my mind changing on over the last 18 months, I'm not going to lie, I probably went through a period too where I've kind of felt like if certain members weren't in the band, then is that band the same? And I've really changed to accept that. Why would we not allow a band to continue to grow, produce new music, try to connect with a new audience, even with new members? And so I've completely 180'd. I support like any band that's out there trying to continue to move forward because bands should be allowed to continue to grow and produce.
And to celebrate the legacy of the band itself.
That's
you
true.
Know, the memory of the members. I mean, that gives us purpose. Without that, the purpose is, so it's the original purpose that we had when we were in the garage as kids. Oh, let's play some songs. And then girls will show up. Oh, wow, the girls are showing up. This is great, you know. And basically, in my case, I'm married, so I do it for one girl. But it's not until you find a different purpose, such as celebrating the legacy of members that have passed,
right?
Like I have been since Randy Rhoads passed away in 1982. That's why I went back to what was called Dubrow and got renamed Quiet Riot when I came back to the group. That it's been, you know, that's been my purpose to celebrate. And even if I'm not playing Quiet Riot music, I still bring what I learned from Randy on stage with me. It's part of my life, you know, the having integrity, not only musically, but in everything that you do in life, you know, and just being focused on the music. Because remember, I come from a generation that we didn't have internet. If you were a musician, no internet, no distractions, taking us away from music, you know. And so it was a whole different focus back then. And if I don't keep that focus, I know that I'm not going to be able to approach. I say approach because I never reach it, but I'm approaching where I want to be as a musician. It's a lifelong journey. And I don't expect to, by the time that I'm over with my life, to actually reach a certain, you know, a destination musically, because there'll always be more that I have not been able to accomplish. I think every musician can actually say that. You know, people talk about, you know, Randy could have been at a certain level. Yeah, but then again, he, even if he passed away at 100 years, he would still be having a new level to reach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree. After we last talked, I did some research, started developing more questions in my mind. One of them is, I came across the snippet of the interview where Kevin had commented that a lot of the bands from the Sunset Boulevard owed their success to him. And for the most part, the only people that I found have pushed back when I put that in there are like really hardcore fans of Eddie Van Halen, which I get their point, but I have to ask. I mean, I think Kevin may have been right, because prior to the Metal Health album and the success it had, like Van Halen, I think, was in the top 60 on the Billboard Hot 100, maybe the 50s. But after Metal Health, it's like all ships rise, and suddenly you see this just influx of bands from the Sunset Strip ending up in the top 20 of the Billboard Hot 100. So I think Kevin was right.
Well, you know, I'm just going to concentrate on the whole Van Halen thing, because the way I see it from being there in L.A. in 1970, I was there in 76 for the first time, but I did not become a permanent resident since 78. I was there in 77 also. So what happened was Van Halen comes in the late 70s, big record. Last band out of LA to get signed, out of the whole Sunset, last one. They shut the door. Here comes punk and new wave. So the door is shut. Nobody. Motley Crue, Dokken, Quiet Riot. These are the bands that were around in the late 70s. Nobody cared. Nobody cared. You know, nobody cared to the point that they release independent EPs. Rack did. So did Motley Crue, you know, because it was the only way to get your music to your fan base. There was a fan base, but the record companies were lagging. Meanwhile, Randy went out there in 79, and he began touring in 80 with Ozzy in England, part of that new wave of British invasion. Metal invasion that happened in the 80s that brought Motorhead, brought Iron Maiden, Saxon, all those bands, including Ozzy.
Priest, yep.
You know, brought him to the U.S. by 83, 84. But prior to that, record companies in L.A., again, because of lack of mass communication of media, you know, like YouTube, exposing bands from all over the world and artists from all over the world, all they care about was going locally. And locally, new wave and punk was the thing. Metal had moved to the Valley and other areas outside of LA. You know, there was a place called the Country Club, which most metal bands did play there, but it was in the Valley. And if you were in the Valley, you were nowhere back then. You know, I'm talking 40 years ago. You know, so in a way, yeah, Kevin is correct. But then again, we came out at the, if it wasn't for MTV, this is a fact, the song Metal Health was the first single on the record, as far as the video goes, and single. MTV, they did not get enough MTV airplay. Come and Feel the Noise, that got the airplay before it got the sales. It was because of the video that the record started selling and the single started selling. So, Yes, it did happen, but also we had a lot of support from the industry, not the record industry, but MTV itself.
So MTV combined with Quiet Riot was that catalyst that created that change.
Yes, absolutely. Not only for us, but look at Michael Jackson, cultural and social changes that have started happening due to that. Yeah, MTV was really, we are a product today, our generation, from what MTV was able to accomplish.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Something else too that I was digging into. So I started taking a look at people's wardrobe before you, and it was predominantly what I'm seeing in pictures are leather and denim. I think you were the genesis of what would end up being associated as the spandex with the Sunset Strip. You had to be one of the first ones, weren't you?
I would say David Lee Roth. And it's because I know the stylist, the fashion designer in charge of that, of Roth's wardrobe, who later on designed our Whitesnake wardrobe. Her name is Fleur. She's known as Fleur, but she's got a last name, Theomeyer, but it's Fleur. And she's the one who sat at not only David Lee Roth, but also Rod Stewart wearing spandex.
Really?
But if you look at the You Think I'm Sexy video and all that, yeah, that's spandex. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go back and look at that. Yeah. Because I was looking at David, and what I was seeing was, I thought was leather, but maybe it wasn't leather. Maybe he wasn't wearing leather pants.
I thought in 1984, yeah. I saw the spandex. 1984, you know, like jumping on
too. Oh, there were like different versions of spandex, and it just got improved as time went on.
Isn't spandex a brand name? It's like some kind of, it's really a material, right? It's not
It's a fabric. It's a fabric, different version of fabrics, and because the original one was really thick, and this one it was smoother. Actually, what I wore with Ozzy was dance skin. It wasn't even spandex. It was ballerino, whatever, you know, fabric. Very close to Lululemon right now. That see-through material. That's very, very close. Yeah. That's but it was because, you know, it was easy to wash, and there's no maintenance. There's no taking care of. It's just like, you know, getting to town the next gig and dip it in the sink, put some shampoo and drip dry and wear it that night, you know? Yeah.
But I don't think there's any arguing. You were definitely one of the early adopters, one of the early influencers.
Yes.
Only by necessity. I mean, you know, our wardrobe, offstage wardrobe, was basically made up of whatever we found in the closet of the girls that would pick us up at the Rainbow parking lot at 2 o'clock in the morning and take us home, because I didn't have a bed. I had a floor to sleep on. So I was easy pickings. And I would go, and if the girl was about my size, I would go through her closet and see what I can borrow. That's awesome. Yeah. To wear, you know. Oh, yeah.
She goes, oh my God, that's my outfit in the video. Yes.
That's your tube top in the video. Yes.
Well, it was definitely interesting when I was going through the Billboard Hot 100 data, and it, whether it's just coincidence, whether it just Quiet Riot happened to be the band at the moment, there is no denying that a lot of things changed after the success of Mental Health very quickly.
Yeah. I got to tell you, again, going back to Van Halen, I think that my favorite record they ever did with David Lee Roth was definitely 1984.
The keyboards came in.
Jump. I mean, Radio Friendly, it's got attitude. But if you listen to the music, it's really well arranged. It's got all this off timing, like in the right before the solo, you know, like little bridge. Like it's off. That's not typical top 40, you know, song type of arrangement. Maybe back in the day, Burt Bacharach had, you know, a lot of that syncopation and time changes in the song, but not really for a rock song. And it was, you know, Panama, I mean, all those songs that came out of that record.
Yeah.
Hustle Teacher. I mean, it was like, wow. What, they had like three or four singles, videos out of that record?
You know,
it's amazing.
Well, you know, Rudy, something. So this is an interesting thing that you're just touching on that Dean and I did a whole kind of show on once. Is it started with Styx. Kilroy was here, right? Remember that album? And we're like,
oh yeah,
Mr. Roboto. And you're like, this is interesting. And then we dug into a Rolling Stone article from that time period, and they were comparing it to, because that came out at that time. That article came out. And Journey's album Frontiers came out at the same time, and it was bands trying to compensate for the new wave movement. So they started bringing in keyboards and stuff, and then we started thinking, well, maybe 1984 was that way, right? It was to adjust to the times. Did you notice that too, that there was an influence on the music to try to change to match what was going on in the environment? Because that's what seemed to have happened in 83, 84.
It's really interesting you mentioned that, because I, as a bass player, I was fully aware of that, because a lot of the British pop, then, you know, because even though new wave was not a big thing in LA anymore, it was still big in England. Bands like Simple Minds or even U2, which was considered new wave at the time, you know, all of that. It was big. And one thing that they all had in common was bass synthesizers, the big sound. You know, so every, you know, when we would be in the studio, we, you know, our producer was also the label. So there was a lot of emphasis on sonic balance, meaning sonic balance with our music and the playlist, the radio playlist. Because what would happen is, once you're done recording, you hand it over to a promo guy. You know, this is the standard back in the day, who's going to go territory by territory, speaking to the station manager to talk him into playing this new song. And there's only 40 spots. It's the top 40 songs that just come out that are going to get that airplay. And it has to be coherent sonically, meaning that it doesn't sound like they changed the radio station. It's like, it has to be like, if you're going to go from a Simple Minds to a Twisted Sister, there has to be some sort of flow, you know, sonic flow, you know. And the sound, it had to be the quality of the sound. For example, the fullness of a, let's say, Simple Minds or Tears for Fears, that big sound. Once you go to a metal song, it has to have that fullness. Otherwise, the people would just switch stations looking for something else that sounds like that.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense.
It really does. Now this is something that just hit my head too. Is how do you think that would have affected Randy? Because Randy left us 2 years before, or a year or two before the new wave thing really started to happen. Do you think he would have tried to adjust to that too?
Oh no! I mean, the new wave thing happened in L.A. in the 70s. That's the reason why he left L.A.
It was.
Oh God, yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had local, the local new wave from punk scene, from the Germs to X, Fear. Oh yeah, it was, and we had to share at the beginning, like when they first came in, there was a crossover period. So before we were kicked out of the Sunset Strip and Madame Wong's, you know, those places were, you know, those were the live music venues at the time. We were sharing the stage with them. And then all of a sudden it became a full bill of like, let's get rid of these guys, of the dinosaurs. Let's get rid of the dinosaurs and just have on the bill every night, just fresh new wave and punk bands.
But what I was getting at, more of the keyboard sounding times, because that's where the Styx and the Journey started introducing.
Okay.
Now, Jonathan Cain was a great piano player, and he started bringing synth, like with Separate Ways and stuff, to match that.
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
In the case of Randy was a musician. To him, it was about the music, not about, you know, how many solos can I play in a record? I'll give you an example. Blizzard of Oz, Revelation Mother Earth. It's piano-centric. Mm-hmm. You know, you listen, the first, you know, the piano solo is in there, and it's the piano is right in your face. And then it's followed by a heavy song, you know. You know, it's still away. This is the song that follows that. That's where Randy gets to rip, you know, during that section. If you listen to the song Diary of a Madman, there's a choir and there's an orchestra in there. You know, it's always with Randy. Yeah, with Randy, it was never about how many solos or how guitar heavy is this record going to be. It was more about the composition itself.
That's beautiful.
I'll be curious on your thoughts, and this is pure speculation, but you know, with Ozzy being nominated for the Rock Hall, which I think we all agree that makes perfect sense. One of the things I'm curious about, and I will watch closely on how they position, you know, Randy's role in that. And I've watched this interview with Dana Strum where he talks about, you know, that whole process of trying to find a guitarist for Ozzy. There's aspects of it that are just hilarious. But do you think, and again, this is pure speculation, if it had been any other guitarist with Ozzy there in the beginning, do you think it would have been the same trajectory of just success? I mean, Sharon's an incredible business person, so hell or high water, she was probably gonna make sure he was a success. But yeah, was the influence of Randy really the big factor in that?
Okay, very simple. How many songs can you name me from records that were recorded after Diary of a Madman?
In Ozzy's catalog?
Yeah.
I get your point completely. I mean, probably a handful. It's a couple from the Jakey Lee days, a couple from Zachy. So, yeah.
How many of those get played at sporting events?
Yeah, great. There you go. Like Crazy Train. Crazy Train is every stadium. Crazy Train is every.
Yeah, how many of those get played on, you know, commercials, movies, TV shows?
Great point.
You know, I mean, you can't compare it, you know. Having said that, I think what happened was that Randy set the bar. A very high bar.
A very high bar.
You need an extra long ladder to touch it.
Great point.
Yeah, an extension ladder. You need like one of those fire truck ladders just to take you to the top of the building.
To your point, Rudy, to this day, people still talk about Randy. And there's other guitarists out there that you kind of go, oh, they're an afterthought, right? So to your point, it's a legacy.
I mean, I even go as far as, you know, I get some sort of messages on social media, you know, from certain people and about, you know, Bob Daisley, who was an incredible contributor to those two records, especially with lyrics, you know. But they might not be aware that Bob continued to record and perform and play on Ozzy's records after I left the band. So he was only really out of the band while I was in the band for maybe 2 years, let's say. Because, I mean, case in point, if you watch Ozzy at the US Festival, Bob is the bass player. Oh, do you realize that?
I paid attention to you in Quiet Riot. I didn't.
See, he came back to the band and he recorded. He was there for Bark of the Moon. He wrote all of that along with Jakey Lee. And I don't know what Ozzy's contribution was. I mean, specifically what it was. I'm sure there was plenty of it. And then he was there for the other records up until No More Tears. How come those records were not as successful as Blizzard and Diary? And I mean successful not just in sales, but as a standard for Ozzy's catalog. Because Randy wasn't there.
As a guitarist who grew up loving Randy, for me, there's always been a finesse of beauty. That's literally what I say. There's a beauty and sincerity, sincerity to his playing style.
Yeah.
That has always touched me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I got to tell you, the factor that is missing after those records is purely Randy. Because everything else except for Lee Kerslake is still there. Bob and Ozzy remain there.
So this is where I'll be watching close. And, you know, I've been very public with my thoughts about the Rock Hall and the way that they approach things. I know that Pat Benatar, as I understand, drug her feet because she wanted to make sure Neil could go in and get recognized with her and that it wasn't just Pat. So I don't know what they're going to do here, if it's just Ozzy or if they're going to, you know, if the greater story goes in with him. So I'll be watching that closely.
I would be surprised if Randy it becomes a major part of that, only because Randy is already in the Hall of Fame. But then again, they might use that as a connection. Randy and Ozzy are both now in the Hall of Fame. You know? Yeah. So either ways, it will make sense to me. The fact that he's already in the Hall of Fame, so let's not put so much focus on him. It just is about Ozzy. Or yes, now they're together at the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I don't know.
There's a clip I pulled that it was a beautiful moment you and Randy were having on stage. And it was just a beautiful moment because as Randy's playing, he's looking right at you. Mm-hmm. And it's so beautiful to see. Because I think it was 79. I think that was the last show Randy did with you all before he left.
Yeah. I believe that was Kevin's birthday. Kevin's birthday in 79 of October 79. Yeah. And I believe it was at the Starwood.
Yes,
and we had a reunion after that in 1980. Randy came home for a few days off, and Kevin put together a reunion at the Starwood too. So that we did that in two nights, but it was different. I mean, you could tell that Randy had moved on from. He had grown so much musically because what happened was. While Randy was in LA with Quiet Riot, you know, his focus was how to get a record deal so we can become professional musicians, you know. And because, you know, having a record in Japan didn't mean anything in LA. We got two records in Japan. Well, we can't get it here. It's not getting airplay on the radio. The record might not as well exist. Now it's different because now it's available on YouTube, so the whole world can listen to it and has access to it. But back then, there was no access, unless you went to Japan to buy the record. And then you have to find it, because after a while, you know, Japan being especially 48-something years ago, 45 years ago when those records came out, it was a very small market, metal or rock and roll. Especially if it's not Japanese rock and roll, if it's an import. So they will only print so many copies and that's it. Once they're out, they're out, they're gone, you know? Yeah, that's the way that market in Japan used to work. I don't know what it is like now. And now, you know, again, you know, there's so much streaming going on, but it doesn't really matter if the record's available or not. You want to hear the music, just, you know.
You just click a button.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
just click a button. Is there an artist or a musician? This is something I wanted to ask you too that you haven't played with yet that you want to.
Well, I think that ship has sailed for me because it was Jeff Beck. But I'm telling you, his catalog, and I listen to him every day because that's what I listen to when I work out, when I go to the gym. And,
so Jeff Beck's your everyday playlist. Jeff Beck is your
everyday playlist. Yeah. And I'll tell you why. It's because I love his compositions, and I listen to is the live performances, because through the years there's different versions of it with different bands, different musicians. He keep rotating his the band members. And I love that because every time somebody else comes in, there's gonna be a whole different slant on the music. You know, he's going to try something different and not play it exactly the same way. And I it's a study for me of musical growth. you know, how he'll take something that's in the studio. Let's say I'm listening to the third album, and I'll listen to a song like Pump, and then hear it live going through different incarnations of the band, how he performs that the same song.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a big loss. We had Steve Hackett on a couple months ago, talking about that very thing, that what a huge loss it was to lose Jeff Beck, because all guitarists, including Steve Hackett, would go, oh, there's a new Jeff Beck album coming out. Okay, what's he going to do to raise the bar again? You know, that's how they were looking at it. He would just constantly do that.
Yeah.
He's one of the guitarists I said has a really strong fingerprint. I mean, when you hear a song, even if you didn't know it was him, you'd go, I wonder if that's Jeff Beck playing on that. His style is just was so him.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like I say, I listen to him all the time. And especially when there's like really, you know, outstanding bass players like Tal Wittenfeld, Pino Palladino, you know, Mo Foster, all these guys, Willie Bascone. I mean, there's, you know, sometimes it's like, who's that bass player playing with Jeff on this tour? And I look it up and I'm like, oh, it's this guy. And then I just go deep into his catalog, you know.
Oh, you see, you're a nerd like we are. We do the same thing. We go down rabbit holes all day long.
It's easier to be a nerd nowadays. Yeah, you know, it used to be hard. You have to go to a library. Where the hell are you going to get all this information? And now it's like, oh, Google, and there it is, you know. Yeah.
Or like blow your check on buying 20 cassettes or albums, right? Because you got to find
I won't go into detail because I know it's it'd be controversial, but there are some guitar solos. There's one in particular, a very iconic guitar solo that I'm absolutely convinced it's not the person that we think it is. And I have a theory of a couple of, but I can't find any information out there to support it. But I can't believe it's the one that we associate it with, but I have a theory of who it could be. But this is the rabbit hole that
what solo is that?
I'm not going to get into it because this would be hugely controversial. Hugely. If we're not recording, I'll share it. If we're not recording, I'll share it with you.
Okay.
I've done years of research trying to answer this question. I found the actual confirmed tracks that were recorded before the official version. They're just so different than the official version. So different. And there were people.
When we hit end recording, I got to know too, Dean. When I hit end recording, we're going to find out. Did you have anything else, Dean, you wanted to bring up with Rudy? I know we just wanted to catch up on these things. Did you have anything else?
I'm loving this conversation. It's very outside the box, you know.
Well, it's. I love that. Well, we're music nerds. And, you know, having you and all that. All the music that we've loved. And, you know, the last time you were on, we were talking about the US Festival. Another thing that really became an interesting topic was the whole tuner situation. You know, Dean brought up the technology. And the technology question keeps coming up more and more because of AI and how things are changing. And, you know, now you got groups, actual music companies now worried about AI in taking their artists' music and changing it. And are you concerned about AI?
UMG pulled out. That's one of the reasons UMG pulled out TikTok.
Yes. So I know that's a Dean question. I just stole it from him. What are your thoughts on the AI?
The way that I look at AI at this moment, because in order for me to have an opinion, I had to experience it. And so I have experienced a couple of, you know, things, me going in there and, writing into the application and giving some instructions. And then I get a result. And I go, you know what? This reminds me of that guy in the band or girl, but usually because my experience has been guys mostly, that will bring up a song that there's something about it, not the whole song, but just something about it. Okay, we can use this part of the song and build on that, but not the whole song. It's kind of like, you know, I think at the beginning, they're going to be collaborators, really good collaborators, because they're there all the time. Anytime that you have some kind of a, you know, a device that can access that app for the AI songwriting, whether it's lyrics or music or both, it's there. You can use it and then get some sort of idea that it will tell you. See, and this is just happening at the moment, because right now there's so much information in the database. The more information that the AI is fed through either robots or humans inputting information, the choices and the quality of the music that they're going to be able to create expands. And it's going to get to the point that it's going to be like, it's going to be, I see this, okay, let's say there's a young generation, and I meet a lot of them on social media who's really interested in classic rock, and they keep listening to Freebird. Freebird, because the band, you know, recorded that years ago, and most of, well, I would say every single member of that original band, they're not longer with us. With the exception of the drummer, and he was not, he replaced somebody else, but you know.
Yeah, once we lost Gary, that was another great player that we lost recently.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so they cannot, you know, they cannot go back in there and kind of like say, okay, we're going to write something like Freebird, but it's coming from the same source. No, it's not. It's not going to happen. So what they do is they can go to AI and say, now, okay, I've heard Freebird 1,000 times. Get me something like Freebird. You know, a new version of it. Or, you know what, how about Lynyrd Skynyrd and David Bowie? What would that sound like doing Freebird? A song like Freebird, not necessarily even Freebird. So the possibilities start expanding. Because to be honest with you, this is what we do. The Beatles are notorious. I mean, you can read this in the interviews. In the early days, they used to sit down and try to write songs like, let's say, Motown. And it would come out like the Beatles. It's a filter. You know, even if you're trying to copy somebody, if you're really original and talented, it's not going to sound like them. It's going to sound like you. It just gives you a reference. You know, the Beatles, they had thousands and thousands of hours playing in clubs before they became prolific songwriters, which means that we're doing copy material and studying them, absorbing what makes this song that is on the radio that we have to play on stage so popular. Oh, it's these composition elements that the song has. Okay, so let's keep that in mind when we write a new song, original song. Let's use those fundamental musical compositions, you know, the ideas, the formula. It's not, you know, a formula can be changed. You can take a formula and rearrange it and put it backwards and forwards or upside down or whatever. It still is a formula because it contains certain elements and they all add up to the same thing. But it can be rearranged completely. That's the beauty of music. You know, so there's always been references. The only difference is instead of having, you know, let's say Lennon McCartney in one room or Keith Richards and Mick Jagger in one room writing a song, now it's just you and this database that has so much information that can actually give you some ideas of where to start with a song. If you have a writer's block, you go, oh, okay, I got something. You know, sometimes I hear music through walls and it doesn't sound anything like the actual song that is being played through the wall because certain frequencies are being filtered out. So your mind, your ear, your mind starts hearing something else completely different.
Yep.
You know, and you can use what you heard different as your new song because it is nothing like what is really being played behind that wall.
So your thought then, Rudy, would be that for the younger generation, they're still going to use it more as a tool and still be creative, not plug things into a thing and say, okay, here's my new song now, and let the machine do it. You think it's more going to be used as a creative outlet then?
Yeah, because the cream, the people who are really, really creative, will still need to be creative, not just push a button and let the machine be creative for you, or the technology be creative for you. No, there's still, see, you know, if we are made in the image of God, the creator, then we are creators too. And, you know, and the first, you know, the, I'll give you, without the act of creation, or it's called procreation, there's no humanity. It ends.
Right.
So that is the singular most important act of creation, procreation. We are fractals. We are fractals from our, you know, ancestors. You know, you can break it down. You know, you are, and then you're, you, if you have children, they are fractals of you.
I guess my fear is,
you know,
the industry, and when I say industry, I'm talking about the business side, the side that wants to make money. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all businesses, one of their goals is to efficiencies, reduce cost. And so my fear is that there's an industry component that if it recognizes that the fans don't care, no longer need to feel like there's a human for them to connect to in the music, that they'll just take the music, then the industry, there are tools to cut out the musician entirely, kick out songs quickly, cheaply, release them, get them to the consumer, and you've essentially cut out musicians in a large chunk. That's my fear.
Well, I think what you, if that happens, it means that is the beginning of the consumer cutting out the industry completely.
You're right.
You know, if you can cut off the musicians, you can cut off the distributor of the music made by musicians, by just going to the app and saying, I want to hear a song like such and such by such and such artist, or maybe a combination of.
What do you need a label for? Amazing.
Yeah, you don't need a label. Right. No.
So right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So they, it's actually a detriment to them to have that tool out to everybody.
You're
they'd
right.
have to control the tool. They'd have to control the tool to be the one.
There's laws. There's laws, you know, for better or for worse. I mean, I'm not a big fan of politics. There's certain individuals that lobby in the favor of musicians. That's why we have Sound Exchange is one of them. We even BMI and ASCAP. I mean, these are things that the industry would try to bypass and put in their pocket until somebody complains about it, then it, you know, they lobby, and then the government gets involved, and there's an organization that protects the right of music, of creators.
That is an awesome perspective right there. I like that. I'm going to dwell on that.
Yeah, that was really good. We got to sit back and listen back to that. That was really good.
That was, I really liked that.
I'm going to have to listen to it myself.
Oh, we'll post it. You blacked out. You like Will Ferrell in Old School when he blacked out.
No, because basically what I went, I just went down the steps of things that I've experienced and I've witnessed. And now is, you know, before Sound Exchange, the performers, musicians did not get compensated for plays. And as a matter of fact, it's only Sound Exchange only covers streaming. If it's what is called terrestrial radio with an antenna, like FM terrestrial, we don't get Sound Exchange from that. And they're trying to change that law also.
That's amazing.
Mm. Interesting.
That's a great way to end this, because that was just awesome. What I want to do, I'm going to hit end, Rudy, and if you can stay for a couple of minutes, because we had some time with you, then Dean can tell a story, because then we're not
going to hear
a story. Yeah, I'm going to hit end here. That'll allow it.